If you enjoy this episode of the Proglodytes Radio podcast, feel free to subscribe on iTunes or through your favorite podcast app so you can keep on listening. Also, head to proglodytes.com for album reviews, artist interviews, and discussion about progressive music. Welcome to Proglodytes Radio Podcast. On this episode, we talked with Scott Shore and Mike Keneally about their latest project, MFTJ, Mankind's Final Traffic Jam. They came out with an album not too long ago, which was self-titled MFTJ, and then they just came out with a follow-up called My Mom's Getting a Horse. Scott Shore is a producer who's worked with numerous artists in the prog and fusion world, and Mike Keneally, as an instrumentalist and producer, needs no introduction. He's worked with Devin Townsend, Frank Zappa, Death Clock. He's worked with everybody. So we had a really great conversation about this new MFTJ album. The music is really interesting and quirky and fun, and best of all, it's got catchy melodies and grooves that you won't just enjoy, but you'll be able to kind of bob your head too. So as a Proglodytes exclusive, we will be playing a track from this album, Shoe Trade Gone Bad, and then we'll get right to the interview. It was really great talking with these guys. They were really funny and engaging. Scott got Mike to tell some stories about Frank Zappa and working with him, and they talked about how fun it was to make this album and just how the process was so unusual. So I think it was a really enjoyable interview, and I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. So here is Shoe Trade Gone Bad from MFTJ's latest album, which can be purchased on the Bandcamp page, mftj.bandcamp.com, or at lazybones.com. Welcome to Proglodytes Radio Podcast. I'm super excited to have this conversation today with Mike Keneally and Scott Shore. Also joining me on the call is Cedric Hendricks, who you may have read some of his stuff on the site.
Greetings and salutations, one and all.
Yeah, so we're super excited to have Mike Keneally and Scott Shore. You, of course, know Mike Keneally's work in many of the various bands he's played with, as Zappa, Death Clock, Devin Townsend, Mastodon. I could go on for a while. And you've probably heard Scott Shore's work as a producer with many of the Levin projects, Marco Miniman stuff. Both of these guys are terrific musicians, producers, and all-around decent guys. So we're happy to have you on.
We're happy to be here. At least I am. I think I can speak for Scott that he too is.
Well, here's the thing is I think this is the first time that Mike and I have appeared together.
It's true.
And, you know, everyone just wants to talk to Mike. I mean, okay, so Zappa and Satriani and Townsend, Prog God. And yeah, he is, you know, notably handsome. But what about me? I mean, so what about me for, okay, I just got one of those air fryers. So I could cook meals and snacks without dousing them in oil. Can Keneally say that? I don't think so.
I can't.
Where's your air fryer, Mike?
Way up on me on that front. There's no question.
Well, Scott, we all know that without a quality producer, the work just doesn't sound the same. So just saying.
Thanks, bro.
Well, in the case of this band, the whole, you know, not to jump right into the topic, but there's no way MFTJ would sound anything like the way it sounds if it wasn't for Scott, because it's really his musical sensibility that is driving the overall effect of the thing. But we'll get into that more.
Yeah, so MFTJ stands for Mankind's Final Traffic Jam. That's a pretty cool name. And by the way, your names are great. Your song names are great. I'm a big fan. Any jokes about Donner Party? Yeah. How'd you come up with the name?
Oh, well, Mike lets me name the songs. I would say I'm a pretty dark person, as you could probably tell by the song names. Much more darker than Mike, although Mike does have dark sensibilities. But sometimes I'll have to pull me back a little bit. That's one of my favorite things. In fact, I like naming songs more than I like writing songs, believe it or not. So, you know, it's just MFTJ to me is very much in the humor world. We really try to keep things light and fun. So hopefully those song titles reflect the vibe of the band.
Yeah, so I read a little bit of how you guys met. But if you wouldn't mind, maybe spark notes for those who maybe aren't as familiar with the MFTJ.
Well, it had to have been on the road, right, Scott? I was in Satriani's band with Marco, and we were coming through your neck of the woods, which was New Zealand at the time, and you had just released Marco's album Eeps, and I was really I was taken with the album. I thought it was, I mean, Marco's done a bunch of really good solo records, but there was something about that that just felt like it was, his thing was crystallized in a really cool way on that record. And I was also taken with the way it was being promoted online with these videos and stuff that were coming out. And so for such a kind of an esoteric album, it seemed to make a splash and everybody was aware of this record, at least in our, you know, little corner of the musical world. So I talked to Marco about that, and he said, oh yeah, well, we're going to be, you know, Scott's going to be coming out to one of the shows and I'll introduce you to him. So I can't remember like the actual location, whether it was in a backstage or if it was after the show out in the stalls or what, but we ended up in a restaurant, during that run and just hanging out with Brian. And it just seemed like our sensibilities were real close to one another. We understood each other pretty much right from the get-go. And so that's just how we connected. And then we just stayed in touch after that.
And then, Mike, you remember I pitched a trio project to you, and that kind of that fell through because you were really busy. That's how I initially broached the subject of working together.
Right. And I was, and it, what's interesting about that is that it was during the course of like casting about for trio participants that I kind of connected with Devin Townsend, and I just reached out to him on Twitter to say, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, doing a trio thing. Are you interested? And he wanted to play bass. And I briefly spoke to Danny Carey about playing drums on the thing, you know, so it my whole connection with Devin started with talking about a Keneally Townsend Carey trio album.
Oh, we got to do that record, dude. We've got to do that one. You guys agree, Cedric? So. Thomas, what do you think about that?
Oh, well, that's kind of a rhetorical question, isn't it? Yeah, let's make sure we get that kind of thing done, shall we?
Yes.
But wow. But it's because I just reached out of nowhere to contact Devin that ended up with me co-producing the Empath album and going on the road as a member of his band. And in fact, that's where I was when the pandemic hit. And, you know, I was doing a North American tour with Devin that got canceled halfway through so that we could all go home and cower.
From a musical standpoint, you guys, how did you know you clicked? I mean, personal chemistry is great, but once you start playing together, how did you know it was going to work out?
I guess you don't. You know, Scott proposed the working methods, because I guess you have done music like this before with other participants, Scott, right? Where you like send rhythm tracks to somebody and they do something on it and send that back to you and then you edit it. Like, you didn't invent this way of working for MFTJ, right?
No, I mean, I did do stuff like that, but it was mostly with unknown artists. I mean, with like the 11 Minimum Rudis and 11 Torn White albums, I did a lot of stuff that I do for MFTJ, but I was really actually intimidated working with Mike, because I'm like, shit, I'm going to, you know, be sending stuff to Mike Keneally. I mean, you know, what do I do if he hates it? And expecting him to just go, nah, I'm not really, my cup of tea. So I do a lot of hip hop and hard rock, and prog is kind of my bread and butter. But so I was actually, Mike, I've never told Mike this, that I was intimidated to send him the tracks and having no idea if he'd respond to it. But it just worked out musically. I mean, we approach music very differently, but for whatever reason, it just gels with MFTJ. It just works.
Well, the way you set it up for me, which was, I'm just going to send you these rhythm tracks. All you need to do is improvise over it, and then send me back those improvisations, and I'll, Scott just goes in with the miner's helmet and finds the little fragments of melody or whatever that feel like the song to him, and he creates the song structure out of my improvisations. He gets melodies and chord structures and stuff. And then he sends that back to me to do another round of improvisations on top of that. And then from that point, we just email back and forth and all the details about song structure and mixes and all that kind of stuff. But it was such a, I mean, in 2 days, I played all of my stuff for the first MFTJ record. I went into the studio and did, I think it was one initial day of improvs, and then I sent that to Scott, and he sent me back all his notes and said, okay, now go in and do it again. And and that's how he creates the sonic world of this music. And for the second album, it was different, because it was the first album that I did my stuff on start to finish on the home studio. It was the first album that I did all my work on, in the midst of the pandemic. So it was a whole new different kind of mindset. And I spent a lot more time doing my initial tracks, partially because it was a home studio and I didn't have any kind of time constraints. With the first album, I had to go into a recording studio. We were paying for time. For the second album, I was just here on my own, left to my own devices, which is always dangerous. And I sent Scott so much stuff, and he, put these songs together. And as I would hear them coming back, I would just go, we both would fairly frequently say to each other, have you ever heard anything like this? Because neither of us have really, we didn't know, we still don't know what it is we've done. but I enjoy that about it. It's one of my favorite things about it.
I really like that you said in the intro that, it's fun music, because I feel like it's two people having a lot of fun. Like, I think that that pervades through the music.
That's great.
And it makes for an interesting bike ride. That's how I heard the first record. I was taking a bike ride and sampling some stuff I wanted to review, and here I am tooling through the park on my fat bike, and I'm like, what's going on right now? This is a little bit off the wall. It's great, but it's a little bit off the wall.
You can still bob your head to it and stuff. You
right.
Bike to it. I think it's really good exercise music.
Well, that's what leads me into this question. Mike, your influences come from everywhere. You know, I know that because I've been listening to you for ages. Scott, the one thing I noticed that was consistent was the groove. It was an airtight, you know, 4/4 driven, you know, 4-on-the-floor type groove. Was that intentional, or did that make things simpler? What was the process there?
Well, I mean, I've been, you know, my primary instrument is drums. So that's really where, to me, the foundation of any great song stems from. And, you know, I wish I was Marco Miniman as a drummer, but I'm not. So, you know, I'm really into the click tracks and keeping things steady. Like I said, I do a lot of hip hop. So I wanted to keep the drums, you know, basic and bumping, because I thought that we could build from there and sort of highlight Mike's parts as opposed to the drums being too busy.
Well, I mean, I love it because it's really hard for me to write a song in 4/4 from start to finish. I always cannot help myself. So working with Scott on this stuff, I get a huge kick out of it because it really places my playing in a very different context from where it normally is. So, the fact that I'm improvising, and with the way my brain works, the moment I'm done playing an improvisation, I can't remember what it is that just happened. So when I send all this stuff to Scott and then he sends me back these provisional song structures stitched together from little bits of my improvs, I don't recognize it as me practically. It's just music that just like showed up on the doorstep all of a sudden. And it's very surreal and it's weird, but it's really, for me, it's really pleasurable. It's really fun. And then doing another round of improvs reacting to it. It's just a really interesting process. And it's a cool project because it's one I didn't see coming. And I also really like the fact that to me, there's a noticeable evolution from the first second to the second record, but they were made, you know, really close to each other and came out real, real close to each other. So I'm feeling like it's a developing project, which is cool.
But Mike, correct me if I'm wrong. I think one of the things that makes this project weird and interesting is when you record one track, let's say you record a track of guitars, and then you move on to the bass, you don't listen to what you just recorded.
Nine times out of ten, yeah. There was maybe one or two songs on this album where I was like chasing a specific thing and would listen to it. But for the most part, that's exactly right. Each track that I play is done completely, divorced from any relation to any other track. So it's all I'm doing is improvising to the rhythm tracks that Scott sends me. Scott will create on his own a rhythm track from drums and percussion and bass and some keys. And then I will do a series of improvisations on various instruments, on guitars and on keyboards and on bass. And in each case, I won't listen to anything else that I played. So it's just a single improv alongside Scott's original rhythm track. And then I send all those tracks per song and he starts combing through them and finding the bits. And I imagine one of the things that's interesting is I'm sure that there are times where things actually line up in a track, just because even though I'm not hearing something else I played, I'm the same guy, so I will respond to certain things in a similar way. But I've never really talked to Scott too much about his working method because I sort of enjoy the fact that it's a mystery to me.
We can keep it a mystery. We don't want to like mess up your guys' relationship or anything.
That's true. A magician never reveals his secrets, so sometimes you may have to keep that one under wraps.
But if you would indulge me, if there was maybe one or a couple times that you just heard what the other did and you were like, damn, that's awesome. What are there any moments that kind of stick out in your mind that just really were fun moments?
The entire record. I mean, it was funny because let me backtrack a little bit. I started this whole thing when I first met Tony Levin, and we did an album called Stickman, and we did it fairly similar to MFTJ. And so Tony and I are sitting in the room, and he says to me, and I was actually really offended the way he said it. He didn't mean it as a criticism, but he said, Scott, he goes, we are so opposite. You know, I went to Berklee School of Music. I know, you know, composition. I know what chords go with what. And you, dude, are so uneducated and so from the street. And some of the choices you make when you try to match up certain chords, I say to myself, fuck, those don't go together. What are you doing? But then I listen to it and I say, oh, but it works. So, and I took that as an offense. I'm like, oh my God, you know, Tony Levin's cutting me down. But that's a thing. And yeah, oh, and then he said, he goes, don't ever get educated in music. It'll ruin you. It'll ruin. So I just go by what sounds right to me. And so with MFTJ, Mike, one of the things when he doesn't listen to maybe a guitar track he does, and he moves on to the bass, and he might use a different chord that might not go with his guitar, but it goes with some other part of the song. So my joy in MFTJ is picking chords that just, you know, logically might not work and might not go together, or rhythms that won't, that shouldn't work in theory. And that's a key theory, music theory, but they work to me. So I guess my stupidity and street smarts and not going to Berklee School of Music and not playing with Frank Zappa it kind of keeps me
clashes that are so cool and memorable, because you know I play with Frank Zappa, but I also like to listen to The Residents and Captain Beefheart and all this stuff where things rub against each other in an extremely discordant way, and it's not about this is the proper note to play over the proper chord. And so some of the most freaking fun and cool moments are where, you know, like, is it Lucy at the Grip of a Crop Duster, Scott, that ends with that bass line?
Those
bass notes mean absolutely nothing to the chord beneath it. And it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it's my favorite bit of music on the whole album, because the way it hits the ear and thus the way it hits the rest of the nervous system, it just works, you know, and it's a thing that I wouldn't have chosen to do ever on my own. So that's why I feel really grateful for this music, because it's such a fun thing for me to hear my own playing completely recontextualized in ways that I wouldn't. But that has such validity, and I think, you know, it is musical. It's like, whether it's conventional, you know, it might not be what the conservatory wants you to do, but the ultimate result is like an object lesson, and this is how music can make you feel. And sometimes the feeling aspect is really enhanced by just putting things together that don't normally go together, but the result of that equation is just like, it can be magical.
But dude, I'm always, and I always will be, I'm always nervous whenever I send you my stuff, because I'm just thinking, oh fuck, he's gonna hate this, what did I just do? So every single time I send you anything, I'm just shitting bricks.
You don't have to, because you know, it's already been demonstrated that I like your musical sensibilities, you know, it's like, and the end results always justify the means. So it's, and the thing that gets me about the music also is the more I listen to it, and I've been doing a lot of interviews and doing all these posts. Well, I was supposed to do a post today, wasn't I? I'll do it tomorrow. I've been like interacting with MFTJ music constantly over the last month. And the more I hear it, the more I like it. And that's not always the case with a project. It's like, you can really get fatigued by something, but every time I listen to these songs, I'm surprised. Like, I can never remember what's coming next, and I'm playing the stuff. So it's like, it's very surreal and fun for me to like be such an intimate part of a project and have it still be so surprising to me. And hopefully some of that energy gets across to anybody who hears it.
The parallel I heard during that entire story was Adrian Belew auditioning for Frank Zappa, because Adrian doesn't read. And, you know, and Mike, you know how arduous his rehearsals were and how demanding he was about his music. So to me, it becomes a question of chemistry. And you two strike me as having quality chemistry. So it's an opposites attract thing, but are they really opposites if you're on the same wavelength and but you just got there from two different origin points? You still wound up in the same place.
Well, if that place, whether we knew it or not, the destination was make some MFTJ music, you know, it's like there wouldn't be any MFTJ music if it wasn't these two guys doing it. So it's cool.
Hey, can I pop on a little tangent for a second, you guys? And maybe this is, you can cut this out of the podcast if you don't like it. But Mike,
tangents are allowed.
I love tangents.
The listeners would be interested in this. I've never asked you, what was Frank Zappa like as a human being, as a person?
Well, he's very human. You know, he's as imperfect and flawed as anyone. But my overriding impression of him when you asked that was I found him to be very warm, actually, and fun loving, which didn't mean that he was like a goofball, but it did mean that the best way for me to decode his behavior patterns was to realize that what he wanted above all was to enjoy himself and enjoy life at any given moment. The contingencies and complexities of moving a 12-piece band and a 40-piece crew around the world to do shows while the band is infighting and breaking up with each it's not always conducive to just having a good time, but he still, that's what he wanted. That's why it was worth it to him to spend all the money and to go to all the trouble. If there was, especially because he was recording, if there was some kind of moment during a show where there was genuine fun happening, his music was so disciplined and so complex. And then to contrast that with these strange moments that just happen that are more humor related, that's where you get to the essence of Frank. He wanted things to be very controlled, and he had a very specific artistic vision, but he also liked it when through something where the universe presented something completely unexpected that worked anyway. You know, he was very much into an environment where those kind of happy accidents could occur. So I saw him as a person, as moving through life like a composer, but he was composing every moment of his day, not just his, you know, he was, it was, I have a lot of different answers to this. Just like, oh yeah, he was fun or whatever. He was very inspiring and daunting character. You know, very young. I was only 25 when I joined the band. And it was very difficult to get past like the hero worship aspect of it. Moments where I could like break out of that barrier that I was putting up as a young man. There were real warmth and real sweet moments where he was very, very kind to me. I mean, the one that sticks out in my mind was at one sound check on the road. He wanted to practice a song called "Can't Afford No Shoes," and the way my relationship into him and my job in the band had developed, if he wanted to try a new song, he would just turn and look at me and wait for me to start playing it. Because I the reason I got the gig was because I was such a huge fan and had so much of his music memorized. So he came to rely on that, and the band sort of, it became a running joke. There's a certain teacher's pet aspect to it. And it also meant that there was a certain pressure on me not to fail. If he looked at me and you know, asked me to do something. So he looked at me and said, play "Can't Afford No Shoes." And the first part of it is fairly simple. And then it gets to this bridge where it just modulates all over to hell and back. And I had never played it before. I was playing the whole song, just like playing the Victrola in the back of my brain and trying to keep up with it, you know. But when I got to this one section, I hadn't cracked the code and I just fucked it up, you know, royally. Instantly, the whole band started razzing me, and Ed Mann got on the microphone and said, "Encyclopedia failure! Encyclopedia!"
That's a good one.
It was a good 30 seconds of everybody in the band just, you know, tearing me. And then Frank just kind of went, oh, okay, that's all for now on that, and we'll move on to something else. At the end, you know, and I was feeling a little abashed. At the end of the rehearsal, he walks behind me, and this was not characteristic of him. He leaned in and he whispered to me, "You're the best new guy I've ever had in the band." And wow. And then he just kept walking before I had a chance to respond. And that, first of all, that moment sustained me during various moments of low moments in my life for years to come. You know, the fact that I could say that happened is the kind of thing that can keep you going. But that was a very sweet thing that he didn't need to do. You know, he could have just left it that. And I know he did it because everybody in the band was razzing me. And he could have just left it there, but he didn't. And to me, when you ask me what kind of guy was Frank, that answers the question.
That's really cool. What did you think of the documentary, as long as we're down this particular rabbit hole?
It was good. I mean, I was really I was impressed and totally satisfied with what Al was able to put together there. And for such a daunting topic, you know, I knew he wanted to make a 2-hour film that would be, you know, satisfying for the hardcore fan, but also informative and engaging for somebody who didn't know anything about Frank. And I really think that he, for me anyway, it succeeded on both fronts. It was totally entertaining for the hardcore, with all the interviews with band members and, you know, definite insights that weren't just, you know, everyday insights and things that have been said a million times, and some rare footage that hasn't been seen. But then it also told a story that I think was engaging for somebody who's new to the whole thing. So I enjoyed it a lot. I thought he did a great job. I was self-conscious because he used so much of my interview stuff in it. I don't, as recreation, sit around looking at myself. So it was really weird for me. But I was grateful that I had so much, that Alex felt that I had so much to offer the film. So that was cool.
That is cool.
Your turn, Thomas.
I did want to ask about the drums. I'm a drummer too. A lot of the drums, there's like some that I can, you know, I get the sense that there's like some programming happening and some that sound acoustic. How did you create the drum sounds? And because, you know, I think that the rhythm section is a huge driver on this album. You know, I just feel like there's a pulse, you know, I noticed a lot of the people who are commenting say, you know, I love to lift weights to this music, or I love to, you know, do different activities because there is like kind of that groove or that pulse or whatever. So I'm curious just how the drums were written and recorded.
Well, I'll start usually with either always a click track and jamming for maybe a minute or two on my acoustic set or my Cat electronic drum set, and just lock into some kind of groove, and then grab a 4 or 8 bar section of it, and then I'll probably replay something else if I choose the acoustic as the main loop. I'll go to my Cat drum set and play over on top of that, so I have something to stack. And then I'll go into my massive library of drum loops from different sources, find the BPM, and put 3 or 4 of those things on. So we've got, you know, just to, you know, different sections of the song, I'll be able to bring in, if I need to, 5 drum sets, right? 5 different beats. And then when we finish, I stack snares for different sections. Maybe put some hi-hats, so we have different hi-hat sounds, and then put the kicks on. So I just want to have as many different drum sets and drum beats that might go with each other as possible. So that's how it works. Does that make sense?
Totally.
It does. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm sitting here wondering, given the current state of the world, obviously it won't happen right now, but this is a highly improvisational record, if I'm understanding it correctly. Is this the kind of thing that you would dare put on a stage?
Well, it's, by the time it's done, I consider it compositional. Even though it's derived, the melodies are derived from improvisations. That's what I find interesting, is that you can feel that sort of looseness to some of the execution, because it all is just stuff that tumbled out without much thinking. But by the time Scott has sliced and diced and placed different things in different places and made motifs and melodies and hooks out of the stuff, I think of them as songs as opposed to improvisations at this point. So they are things that could be learned and performed. And I think actually that would be the only way to really do justice to the music, rather than just say, okay, we're going to go up there and jam on this groove. Because that's how the music is born, but it's not where it's headed. Like neither of us, when thinking about making MFTJ music, are thinking, yeah, it'd be cool to just put out a bunch of jams on grooves. It's about finding the bits of the jams that want to become a song. And then, so if we were ever going to do a live thing of this, it would require, unless we were just playing, you know, if the majority of it was on tracks and we were just playing along with that, but that doesn't excite me as much as the thing that would be impossible to do because it requires a large budget. But but if it was possible to put together an ensemble of players that could cover the amount of keyboard and guitar overdubs, because at any given moment, because I'm throwing him so many tracks per song, you might be hearing three guitars and four keyboard parts and two basses, the one Scott played and the one that I played. The way these things come in and out all the time is a big part of why the music sounds the way it does. And if I was going to play this music right, I would want to like transcribe it and make charts and make sure that everybody really knows how the parts go. But that's maybe in the next life there will be time.
Yeah, well, I'm sure all you festival promoters and all you folk are definitely listening to this podcast right now. Take note. Devin Townsend, who's the other one? Danny Carey, if you're listening. You got a band you can play with. I wanted to ask, because I another thing I really enjoyed about it is there's a strong visual component. I love the videos. If you go to the Bandcamp page to buy the album, at the very top, it starts with that dating video from the 80s that's so hilarious. But there's these great videos that accompany some of the songs, and so I'm wondering how those are made and what's kind of the. They look a lot of fun, so I'm just curious.
That Scott is the driving force, but just as he is with the song titles, Scott is the driving force behind the videos as well. And so what's your methodology? Because there's a real distinct sensibility to all the MFTJ video stuff.
Well, Thomas, as you probably realize with the videos, maybe you didn't, but I would say if Mike and I had any disagreements, it was in this world, because my darkness sometimes just gets so bleak. So I would put together these videos and send it to him. He'd be like, dude, what the fuck is wrong with you? I can't put my name on that. So I go back. Well, what shots didn't you like? Well, like from beginning to end, probably all of them maybe. So I'd go back, you know, and change it. And, you know, we might go through seven or eight just different versions until finally he goes, yeah, man, that's dark enough, but not just where the people want to just put us away, you know. So I just kind of go with my gut and I just grab a bunch of footage. It takes me forever to find this footage. I'll spend days and days on YouTube and the dark web, you know, crazy sites, and just grab in as much footage as I can. And whatever I'm feeling, you know, and hopefully keeping really good sense of humor with it. And we'll end up with what we do. So that's how we do our videos.
Yeah, I think it's definitely a time where, you know, the record creates this world and the videos kind of give you a visual thing, like a visual component to that to kind of pull you in. Like, I definitely think it creates an overall vibe that's very attractive, you know, kind of like in a sense that like the type of person that is into it will catch on, you know. And I guess I'm thinking that's me, because I'm always looking on YouTube for dumb videos and weird videos and old 50s found footage and stuff like that. So, yeah, they're a lot of fun.
That stuff has vibe to it. It's like it's like it's funny, but it also just makes you feel weird to see that stuff. And yeah, I do enjoy that world. I am comfortable in that world, and I guess every once in a while some set of images would come down from Scott where I did kind of feel like, I don't know if I totally want to put this out in the world, but the, you know, overwhelmingly the stuff that Scott comes up with, I just think is it reminds me of like weird early 80s, you know, like the type of downtown New York City weird video vibe that was going on that might show up on like Night Flight on the USA Network. Some of the stuff that just odd alternative approach. It's that stuff was really appealing to me then, and it still is. And I do sort of like think of MFTJ as being in that sort of weird underground downtown art video scene kind of vibe. That's the way the video hit me.
Yeah, but Mike, I have to say, like, I've gone back, you know, looked at like the first versions I've sent you, and thank God for you, man, because I'll look and I'll go, I'm sick. I need some help, man. I need therapy. I need serious intervention.
I guess
so. I'm really glad that you were there to kind of, you know, save our careers.
I'll ask the question from a more macro view. I think Thomas is going to take it from more micro, because he mentioned the videos and how, shall we say, off the beaten path they are. I'm thinking the same thing when I look at the song titles. I mean, where does that come from?
You know, guys, you might never see me after this interview. I might need to check into some, you know, facility. I'm weird, man. I'm broken. You know, I think of weird stuff and I write it down and send it to Mike and he goes, yep, love it. So I don't know where it comes from. Just crazy ideas, crazy phrases I might hear, or adding words that shouldn't go together. Yeah, I don't know. Just, it's one of my favorite things to do. Literally one of my favorite things in the world to do is name songs.
What about bands? Do you like naming bands?
Love naming bands.
Yeah. Because, I mean, Hemi Crotch Pong is a great name for a band. I'm just thinking.
That's Mike's name. Mike came up with that name.
I did?
Yes.
Hemi Crotch Pong.
Did you?
I did. I don't remember naming it. I that was the one song I did editing on, but I don't think.
I think you named that one. I really do.
I'm gonna disagree.
Okay. All right.
So if you do it, check yourself into therapy. You'll just be like, "Well, it was Mike that did it to me. He made me weird."
I thought you asked for one to name, and I thought that was it. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, because I remember the reason I know that I didn't name that one is because it took me like 2 weeks to realize, oh, that's what it means.
because okay, I take credit.
Yeah,
there you go. Anyway, yeah, I think Cedric's question about the naming of, is it like you listen to the song and you're like, this comes to me, or with Mike, when you get the files, do they already have a name, or no, because you're improvising over stuff, so it's probably just little snippets here and there, huh?
It's mainly like this album for the most part all started as about 2 minute grooves, and the titles aren't titles, they're BPM numbers and keys. So it might say 120 BPM in A minor, and that's the only way the song is identified to start with. And then I set about just doing a series of improv tracks in A minor or whatever the key is, without listening down to the last one for each one that I do. And so at this point we're not even thinking about titles, but at some point during the course of Scott editing my improvs, I don't know if you have like a book of titles waiting for songs, or if it just occurs to you during the editing process.
Well, both, but I have just a ton of titles written down. So guys, here's my favorite song title of all time that Mike was offended by. Now, honestly, I want to know, are you guys offended by this title? It's awesome. Listen. Never bring your wife to Bangkok.
Are you sure you didn't play with Frank Zappa, Scott?
I hated that one.
Well, as someone who was almost
that title. Does that offend you?
No, as someone who was almost assigned to a duty station in Thailand briefly, I think that's good advice, because there's a lot of strange things happen over there. And while I'm on the subject, during my 15 or 20 minutes of being an avid guitar player, I came up with a couple of nonsensical song titles, one of which I may or may not mention, but I'm challenging you to come up with some music for Shoe Shopping with Millipedes.
Like that. Dude. That's a good one.
So, So, you know, challenge thrown down. You let me know what you're doing. And what the hell, I'll give you the other one. My sushi tastes like Astroglide.
There you go. You guys are on the same wavelength.
Like it was based on the story.
That's a good one.
Have at it. If you let me throw in a track of noise somewhere, you know, I'll be happy to do that.
I love it.
Well, as far as titles go, I'm very happy that Scott's got control of that aspect of MFTJ music, because I already have an outlet for my weird ass titles, and there's plenty enough weird song titles on my solo records, so I don't feel the need to impose myself that way. As a matter of fact, I'm wondering now, Scott, I think at one point I was proselytizing for removing the name, the word crotch pong, and I just wanted to call the song Hammy. But that's so not an MFTJ title. So I'm very glad that we, you know, stayed on with the crotch
pong. Yeah, Hammy's too tame, bro.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, you gotta have some crotch pong, man.
there's a commercial I want to see, you know, on the news, you know. Ask your doctor about crotch pong.
Oh man. Oh, great, guys. So this album you can find on the MFTJ Bandcamp, which is mftj.bandcamp.com, and you can also get it through Lazy Bones. Is it lazybones.com?
Yes, sir.
Very cool. So you can get you can pick your preferred place. I bet the better one is to go through the website, huh?
Well, Scott is Lazy Bones,
right?
So that works. Well, I guess if you're, I mean, that's the thing with Bandcamp is if you, unless you do Bandcamp Fridays, I guess Bandcamp gets a cut. So ultimately it probably does benefit the act to go directly to Lazy Bones.
Yeah, but my Bandcamp, it allows these beautiful fans, and often many of them do, pay much more than the asking price. So I love Bandcamp.
And yes,
I believe that in this day and age when people take music for granted on Bandcamp, you put down what, $9.99 for a download? People paying $15, $20. I mean, love it. We love those kind of music fans. This is how we make our living, right? I mean, this is how we pay our bills. There's no other no day job, so. Bandcamp, love it.
It's an amazing platform, and it's certainly become. That's where people sort of understand if they're the sort of music fan who wants to support an artist rather than exploit an artist. That's the place to go. You know, it has definitely emerged as the platform for that kind of music lover, and it's MFTJ is my first interaction with Bandcamp, and I'm like really sold. So later this year, I'm intending to introduce my catalog to Bandcamp as well.
That's a fantastic idea because, yeah, Bandcamp is there's no competition as far as the other distribution ones.
Yeah. Bandcamp is the perfect answer to everyone who wants to gripe that there's no good music out there anymore or that modern music sucks. And right. I'm like, you know what? You're looking in the wrong place.
Right. Very true. And there's a lot of good stuff there. So, yeah.
Very cool. So definitely check these albums out. There's MFTJ1, and then this new one's called My Mom's Getting a Horse, which sounds very exciting. The cover has a beautiful looking horse person. This is like a reverse centaur, right? Because it's got a horse head and the human body.
Yes.
Did you guys ever see that SNL about the Christopher Walken interviewing the centaur for the job?
No, I didn't.
No, I can look that up.
Such a good one. The entire thing, he's just asking him all these dirty questions about being a centaur. He's like, if you're looking at the back end of a horse, are you aroused? And he's like, this is a job interview. It's pretty good. Can I talk about something else, please? He's like, no, we got to get to the bottom of it. Yeah.
Can I pimp my Patreon account real quick?
Oh, absolutely.
Right, because I've really the talk about Bandcamp kind of reminded me of that, just in terms of places online where artists can kind of build a world. Enjoying that aspect of Patreon, because if an artist starts a Patreon page, they can post whatever they want that's related to their career. And the analogy that I used at the outset was it's like a box set. that doesn't stop, you know, with like a set of liner notes that just keeps growing and growing and growing. So every month I've been putting unreleased music up there, and we've been doing live chats where there's, you know, real-time interaction with people and scans of drawings and my rehearsal notes from the Zappa tour and video stuff. And I'm going to be posting some exclusive MFTJ making of footage at the Patreon account. So it's just, like I say, it's kind of a world-building thing, and I've really been enjoying building a world over there. So if anyone who's, you know, interested in what I, it's, you know, just patreon.com/MikeKeneally, they might be interested in checking it out.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love Patreon too. I encourage all my musician friends to take that avenue, because it's, I think people want to support musicians, and sometimes it's, you know, you're waiting for an album to come out. Well, an album will sell for $10 or $15 or whatever, but Patreon, it gives you a way to, you know, either statically contribute money over a period of time or contribute anytime something's released. It's an awesome way to know you're supporting, you're like making it happen. It's really cool. I think of all the, you know, crap you could talk about that's happening in the world, like, and especially when it comes to music business and all that stuff, there's some really cool things happening too.
Artists have been forced to find alternative ways to get their music and themselves out there and to try to figure out a way to support themselves, especially now that there's no live music going on.
Right, exactly.
This stuff is essential. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for the platforms that exist now as an artist. It's I'm like, it's a world that I'm becoming more and more comfortable in.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, I got one more question. Since you brought up live work, let's say for the sake of argument that the vaccine gets distributed the way it should get distributed by summertime, and we're in that 75% range and the numbers are falling. How long do you think it's going to take for bands to get themselves back out there and get on stage?
I don't know, man. I mean, like last year, you know, we have the Zappa band, a band made up of Zappa alumni for the most part. And we were supposed to open for King Crimson last year, and that was postponed precisely 1 year. It was supposed to be June and July of last year. And at that point, you just think, well, yeah, a year from now, obviously everything's going to be back to normal. You know, it's like,
right,
we've now all been through this for nearly a year. And I think we all know it's never going back to normal. Whatever pre-COVID was, that's done. So from now on, there's not going to be a post-COVID existence. It's just going to be varying degrees of living with COVID, I think. And that's Marcus Reuter, who I did a talk with earlier today, that had that observation. There really is no after COVID. And so it seemed well within the likelihood that we would be able to go out and do this King Crimson tour in June and July of this year. I have no idea. And I would be extremely surprised if it was possible to do gigs that soon. I just don't see it coming. I think, it feels to me like maybe by September, October, things will start to get back to normal. But, you know, I'm just glad that things are in a shifting mode right now in this country. And it feels like it's a little bit more of a taking care of business mindset, and that a lot of the ridiculousness that we've been having to exist with is changing. You know, it does feel like this is a transformative year, but it's hard to say how long the transformation is going to take.
Yeah, well, we'll have our fingers crossed. Yep. And just hope. And in the meantime, just keep trucking forward and finding new ways to make music happen like you guys have. I mean, literally on opposite sides of the world, you're making music. That's pretty cool. You know,
that's incredibly cool.
It's really cool that you're able to do that literally on opposite sides of the world.
Just literally. Be very, very careful about scheduling phone calls.
Ain't that the truth? That's kind of like, you know, being, you know, I saw some comic where it's like, hey, you want to start a band? Hey, and you look at each other's schedule and it's like, it was nice knowing you. Sorry. It doesn't look like this is going to happen. It's all about scheduling, I think. But Yeah. So thanks so much for coming on. I really enjoyed this chat and really enjoyed the album. It's really cool. The vibe is awesome. And Prague isn't always, I mean, I wouldn't probably call it Prague because I don't like that word very much, but
yeah,
you know, the music that I am kind of immersed in with the website can often be pretty stale and uninteresting, just and I feel like there's a really cool and interesting and quirky vibe to this that I really like.
Thank you very much.
So thanks. Fittingly, I'm going to ask you some weird questions, and you can talk as little or as much as you want. So what is the most beautifully weird song you can think of right now? So both beautiful and both weird. And I know that's a world that you both kind of dwell in, but what do you think?
The one that just came to mind is In the Neighborhood by Tom Waits. Because it just sounds like somebody caterwauling, but there's something absolutely beautiful and heartbreaking about it, which of course that's a world where Tom Waits lives a pretty good amount of the time. But that's the one I got.
I'm going to say a song off Marco Miniman Eep's record called Sushi Cat Doll, which is like a 14-minute song that encapsulates beautiful and weird.
I haven't heard that one. I love Marco's stuff, though.
Check out Eeps. It's a really interesting record.
It really is.
I need to hear that one myself.
Oh, man, you do.
Yeah. And another last question. Have you guys taken on any... I hear people talking about hobbies all the time, like outside of work, knitting or crocheting or, whatever. Do you have any weird new hobbies you've taken on? Or shows you've binged?
I haven't developed any new hobbies because I'm just trying to keep up with the projects that I'm supposed to be doing. But when I'm done working and I sit down, yeah, there is some binging going on. And right now there's a show that we're really enjoying called Amy Schumer Learns to Cook.
All right.
that's an interesting concept right there.
Good. It's a very enjoyable show.
Yeah, that's a great thing to do because lots of people are door dashing and getting food delivered and stuff like that. So I keep on thinking every day, like, oh, it'd be a great time to cook. But then I still make myself ramen. So,
well, she's a really good chef. And so the conceit of the show is that he's teaching her to cook. But a large portion of the time, it's just him cooking. But it's,
yeah.
I'll tell you, you order DoorDash a couple of times and you'll be much more motivated to cook, I guarantee you. DoorDashing gets expensive.
Yeah, Scott. Old French fries.
You watching? Are you binging anything? I don't even know if you watch television.
Well, both a hobby and a show. Korean interpretive dance is what I'm kind of getting into. So I'm learning it as a hobby, and I think that's a TV show. And if not, it will be soon.
Well, you can't see into the future. You're in the Australia area.
That's so right. Now you're getting it.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much for coming out, and we hope to hear more from MFTJ. And
thank
from your
you
respective
really
stuff.
Enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Yeah. May I take 2 seconds and thank Mike Keneally. I don't even know, are we videoing this? Because I'm going to shamelessly hold up my book.
Oh, right on.
it's getting blurred. It's like it's
yes,
censored.
It happens. It's called I Can't Be the Only One Hearing This. A Lifetime of Music Through Eclectic Ears. What does that have to do with Mike Keneally? He was kind enough to write the foreword for me, for which I have thanked him 10,000 times, and I guess this will make 10,002 because I will forever be grateful for that.
My pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure, Cedric. It was honored to be asked.
I appreciate it. Available on Amazon, ladies and gentlemen.
All right. Well, thanks so much, and good evening, good morning, good afternoon. We're covering quite a bit of time zones, so yeah. Take care, y'all.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.